Greetings and salutations, everybody. This is David Bixenspan welcoming you to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast. I hope everyone enjoyed the
Bix. Bix, are you listening?
What?
Have you figured out who I am yet?
Sounds like a Jewish cookie monster.
You already used that joke on Between the Seats. I see you losing control. Where is your confidence?
What kind of name is Oli anyway?
Scandinavian, I gather.
I think he's Polish.
I have a synthesizer. Bix!
Yes?
I want to show you some of my black magic.
That was your black magic?
Wasn't black magic that valet that Dick Slater used to have?
No, that was Norman Smiley. No, his valet was not Norman Smiley. Black magic was Norman Smiley.
Al Perez.
What about him?
I'm not Al Perez.
Well, that's... So, are...
Sting, Bix, I forgot who I was talking to. I have waited for this moment.
What?
Los Angeles on the beach, 1986. Think about it.
What about Tulsa?
I don't know her.
Okay, this is tough.
What do you want me to do? Talk about pride or something?
Anyway. That was... Oh my god. If everyone hates this, it was Ryan's idea.
Yeah, first of all, I think I need a throat lozenger. But yeah, I started playing around with the Black Scorpion voice, and I think I need a swig of water for the Black Scorpion right about now. But yeah, it was my idea. Sorry. Sorry if it's not serious enough for you.
I don't know if that's the problem.
I know there's a lot of problems with it, but whatever. Welcome to another episode of 605, the Super Podcast. I'm Brian Last. That's David Bixenspan. We got a lot to talk about this week. I guess we should start, Bix, by following up on a few things from last week's episode.
Yes. I made a mistake, and then it didn't really matter, but whatever. So you may have noticed that we talked about Giorgio Moroder and our theme song, and then I think I put a note in the blog post, which would have been, in the description in the podcast apps, if you used one, that said to disregard all of that. So for some reason, okay, so what we had decided to make our theme song at first was the dub mix from the 12-inch of Grab Them Cakes from the wrestling album. Which I did put on SoundCloud, and we'll link that so people can hear it. But for some reason, I guess because we were talking about Moroder, and I already had in my head that was the theme song, I was like, oh, right, and he was the person who remixed it. No, it was Shep Pettibone, who is a, what would he best known for, mixing a lot of Madonna stuff?
Yeah, I would guess so. I mean... The way it started was last week on the episode, we said, hey, if you could figure out what our theme song is, let us know.
And then we used the
And then we used the theme song that everyone knows, which until actually this all happened, I didn't realize was an actual song. It was a song used by the NFL in their NFL films, and was also used, obviously, as TBS Wrestling's theme song.
Yes.
Richard Harvey, I believe, is his name.
Yes, and now I forgot the name of the song. Wait, was Dynamics the name of the song or the album?
I believe it was Dynamics by Richard Harvey.
Yes. Which is on YouTube in various forms, although the one that's actually just listed as his and not the World Championship Wrestling theme, I think it sped up. Like someone put it on a record player at the wrong speed, or their record player got out of whack. But yes, apparently a real like kind of disco-ish sort of instrumental song. But yes, that's what the deal was there, and the dub mix of the... of Junkyard Dogs Grab Them Cake song with Vicky Sue Robinson, which is, yes, a real thing. There was a real 12-inch single of that and Land of a Thousand Dances. When I tried to you know, as like many people do on podcasts, I use a program called Levelator to automatically match up the audio levels on everything. And when I tried to use that song, it just completely threw everything out of whack for some reason. Like the level, like because it goes, I guess, from back and forth between, because it's a dub mix, quiet, loud, quiet, loud. So without boring anyone too much, I couldn't use that. So we decided, hey, we'll use one of our second choices, which was the World Championship Wrestling theme, which I think works well.
Also, on the topic of theme songs, I know last week I said I couldn't remember the Paul Orndorff WWF theme song that he used in 1985. It was actually I'm a Fighter by Van Zandt. So if you want to hear that, go find that. And then I guess the
would this be Lynyrd Skynyrd Van Zandt or Little Steven?
Donnie Van Zandt.
So what from Lynyrd Skynyrd?
It would be a relative of Ronnie Van Zandt.
Isn't he the one that replaced Ronnie in the touring group when they reformed?
Well, I'm not a big Lynyrd Skynyrd aficionado, but I know Ronnie Van Zandt died in the plane wreck, and then this says Donnie Van Zandt, and then I believe Johnny Van Zandt ended up playing with them later on. And I could be wrong. I could be getting names mixed up.
Okay.
I don't know. Ask Michael Hayes about the various incarnations. Yeah. Going on, another thing we talked about last week, which became somewhat of an obsession of mine this week, was El Pibe Diaz, this wrestler from the famed Argentina wrestling group Titanes en el Ring. And I said that he's one of my favorites because of the ridiculousness of it. It's a man who comes out to the ring in pink overalls with a bunch of dancing girls. None of them are dancing to the same song. They're all just doing their own thing. And children are running up to him and kissing him. And then he dances, and his dancing is so infectious that eventually the heel that he beats and William Boo, the heel referee, all dance with him. I mentioned that there was another El Pibe Diaz after this one left, and he wasn't as good. Well, in doing some research this week, not only was there another El Pibe Diaz, but he's also on YouTube in what could best be described as almost killing himself, if not killing himself.
Because we just don't know.
We really don't know. There's no conclusion. No one has turned up with any new information about this. Bix, when I sent you this video and I said you have to watch this, of the second, we presume the second, who knows how many there were, El Pibe Diaz landing on his head, what did you think?
I thought he had literally died.
He literally, well, we're going to actually watch the video together here on the show and let you know our actual thoughts.
Okay, so are we doing this now?
Let's do this now. What we're going to do is create a playlist after the show. So if you want to see it, it'll be there for you to watch.
Okay. So this starts with – now, is this clip of this entrance from this match? Do we know? Because it seems
– yes.
Okay.
Now, the differences are night and day. He's not wearing pink overalls. He's wearing some kind of Martian headgear, I guess is the best way to put it.
Antennas. And he's not – as good a dancer.
He's not as good a dancer. He's busting out splits left and right, and instead of the dancing women, he has a bunch of children also wearing the antennas on their heads.
Between the dancing style and the hair, he's kind of got a Mario Lopez vibe going.
Yes, very much so. And I've already seen one split, and he almost went for a second split. And the match hasn't even started yet. Now all the children are coming in the ring, and I can't tell if they're dancing or just standing there. He's certainly... they're all dancing.
And now Situation by Yaz starts playing as he dances, and he does a split. He does the Boss Root and jumping split. And also, the thing is, with Titanes en el Ring, they were well known for being the first wrestling promotion anywhere to have specialized entrance music written for the wrestlers. So in any other promotion, like, using commercial music would be a good sign, but in Titanes en el Ring, it's a bad one.
Yeah, this is from 1983, this clip, according to YouTube.
I mean,
yeah.
I think they ended I think they lasted maybe even to late 80s in some form. I'd have to read the Martin Caradagian bio again to remember exactly when. But this is pretty much the end. Unfortunately, most of the videos from this. Okay, so he's facing, who's this, El Diavolo?
No, this isn't. This is some man I could only describe as he's wearing a red durag and a yellow shirt,
okay,
and his durag's off.
Pause this for a second. Okay, so he drop kicks him out of the ring. He drop kicks. Who's our opponent here again?
They didn't say a name that
they
picked up.
Didn't say on this one. Okay.
No. The name of the video is Accidente de El Pibe Diaz.
Yes. And boy, is that correct. Okay, so drop kicks him out of the ring. This Rudo takes kind of a labored bump. One of the things when you first showed me this and we're watching this, I'm like, those ropes have me very worried.
They are very loose. They are very, very loose, these ropes.
So this Rudo, whose name we don't know, he's selling on the floor, kind of starting to feed.
He looks like he's about 50 years old. Yes. He's a rather overweight man, or somewhat overweight, in a giant yellow shirt. That's all we know about him.
In the spot I just froze it on now, he just looks like a fan in the front row.
He does not look like a wrestler at all.
No.
And his reaction to what's about to happen may show that he wasn't a wrestler. God. Start the video back.
Okay. I was going to see if I could alter... God damn it. I was going to see if I could adjust the volume on my mic. But yeah, let's just get back to this here. Okay, so... The camera's on the Bruto. Oh, my God.
Never gets old. Pause it. So basically what happens is El Pibe Diaz.
You can't really see because there's a guy in front of the camera. The camera is on the guy on the floor. And then Pibe Diaz just.
Is on the floor.
I guess he catches his feet on the ropes a la JT Smith. Presumably. We can't tell. And he does a dive. And he does a
nasty, nasty header right onto the floor. And now his opponent, in his infinite wisdom, decides to start yanking the unconscious Pibe Diaz up by the arms forcefully. And it looks really, really bad. And now all the children that came to the ring with him are running over there and they're jumping in and trying to do it. And now, I mean, I don't know if I'm missing anything. Now the children and the opponent and some other are carrying the unconscious, clearly injured Pibe Diaz and running out of the building with him.
A situation starts playing again.
This may be my new favorite wrestling clip of all time.
I'm going to assume that there was a third Pibe Diaz after the second one died.
Yeah, I mean, this is just so brutal.
You somehow can't help but laugh at it. It's not that he lands on his head. It's the way the guy immediately yanks him up.
And then the children all running over there, like they were going to do something to help.
What are they doing?
It's just there's so much chaos going on. And then just the idea, you know, if you have a head injury or a neck injury, they want you laying there. They want to put something around your neck. They want to have a doctor look at you, put you on a firm, hard surface, carry you up.
So.
They just try to yank him up forcefully, and then they all just pick him up and run out of the building with him. Children, opponent, and everyone. I mean, it's unbelievable, this clip.
Oh, my God.
You're watching it again, aren't you?
No, I'm reflecting, but I'm going to watch it again now.
Yeah, here comes the dive. Boom!
And this guy does not make any effort to catch him. He just stretches his arms out.
If you didn't know he came from a ring, you would think he just dropped from the ceiling.
Yes, I mean this guy. Like, I don't know how much.
Some of these children are mortified. There's a few of them like holding their mouths.
Yeah, I'm making this full screen so I can. Also, the bump this guy takes out of the ring is not. Oh my God!
I'm sorry. This is getting funnier each time I see it. I recommend you watch this in a loop. Just not stop.
He catches dives like someone trained in Florida Championship Wrestling. Jesus.
Hey now.
Have you seen how most current WWE guys catch dives? It's not pretty.
No, I've actually given up on WWE.
No, I know, but literally anyone other than Cesaro, pretty much, it's not pretty. It's not this bad, though. I mean, but if you've ever seen The Miz catch a dive, it's not that dissimilar from this.
Well, this man clearly did not catch anything.
Well, I'm sure he caught a few things in his lifetime, but dives weren't one of them.
Now, we recommend all of you watch this clip, but the bigger question...
Over and over.
Over and over... The bigger question, if anyone has any answers, did this guy die? What happened here? If anyone knows.
He's clearly unconscious.
Who's an expert in the field of
it
this?
It would be Kurt Brown and Steve Sims.
All right. We need to crack down on this. This will be an ongoing thing. The investigation into the life and death of El Pibe Diaz.
Maybe next week we will call Kurt during the week and add a segment. Kurt, we will call Kurt or Steve. Actually, I may be talking to Steve about something else during the week. We'll ask him if he knows about the death of the second Pibe Diaz.
You know, I don't know why this reminded me of it, but did you ever see that tape of it was from, you know, I had it when I used to have tape parties in the 90s. Handicap Pro Wrestling?
Yes. I mean, I've seen more of it than most people, probably.
Okay, I only had one tape of it. And I remember it was a big hit at every video party I had. And then one time in New Jersey for one of Dennis Caruso's Eddie Gilbert shows, I actually had Bill Watts in the room watching it.
Oh, my God.
And he went crazy. He thought it was the greatest thing he had ever seen. He's like, what? He's like screaming at the TV, like, look at that guy in a G-string. He really
was. Because they're also doing shoot style, I guess, because they decided it's the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, he thought it was great when the guy started crying and the match ended. Add that to my resume. I got to watch Handicap Pro Wrestling with Bill Watts.
Where did you get that?
I got it from the only person I know who would enjoy it as much as me, Bob Barnett.
Oh, so you got it from him? Because I got it from him, and then later, I believe I got when you know because they were still running in Japan, you know that promotion Dog Legs. Yes, that was what it was. I think it's still
that was the name of it. Yes, Dog Legs.
Dog Legs Super Handicapped Pro Wrestling. And well, it was. I got it, well, because it was. I saw they were airing on TV in Japan, and so I contacted a certain tape dealer who may or may not live in the Northeast, not that one, who gets stuff from Japan. I'm like, do you get this? And because there was also a DDT show that no one was getting that was on the same network. So it's like, do you get both? Do you get these? And he's like, yeah. But he didn't list it. Probably for obvious reasons.
Yeah, really.
And I got like one tape of it, and then my friend Nate, who loved collecting the weird Japanese indie stuff, got another month of their half-hour show from him.
How long did it run? Do we know anything about this?
It still exists. There's a guy who made a documentary that's like been crowdfunding it or something. Like if you look up like Dog Legs Wrestling Movie or Handicap Wrestling Movie, you'll find it. And I mean, they've been running a very long time, but I remember then the second when Nate got his, like, I remember it was the end of the tape had like the beginning of that week of that month's DDT show on that network, and it had this like amazing looking match where it was like Dick Togo and like what was his name? Hideki Nishida, who was this guy who we both loved watching, who I think was like the second Monkey Magic after Super Delphin. And it was this like clips of this amazing match, but it was it was hyping for that match being later in the episode. And then later when Nate was like, oh my God, this looks amazing. Now we have to get the DDT show. He contacted said tape dealer who may or may not have the same initials as Jerry Lynn. And he said he did not have this DDT show, which I don't know if he did not want to sell anything else from the same tape. Or if he did not want to ever play the Dog Legs tape again to get to the DDT show. But yeah. As far as I know, it still exists. I don't know if they have TV or anything, but they still exist.
You know, watching this too, I also think about some of the other hits at those tape parties they used to have were just videos of wrestlers landing on their head. There was Devin Storm at the 1994 NWA tournament in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, against Tracy Smothers in the first round of the NWA tournament.
And then you're going to say Lupus next, right?
Lupus was the one I filmed. Did you ever see that?
Yes, Bob put that on the same tape as the Handicap Wrestling, I believe.
Yeah, I filmed that. I was there that night. It was one of the worst places I ever went, Vineland, New Jersey. It was all the way down at the bottom, the bowels of New Jersey, in the middle of nowhere. And it was a really crappy show. But, you know, Dennis's shows were always fun to hang out. And we went there, and I was filming it. And it was a three-way match between Lupus, I want to say Twiggy Ramirez, and a third person who I can't remember.
Off the Starling, top of my head. Derek Domino, Devin Storm.
I don't think it was any of them. I think it was kind of like the B team. So
what's the B team? What's the word?
Those are like the main eventers of Dennis's stuff. I consider this like the B team of Dennis's stuff. And I can't remember who the third person is. No, he was a manager. He was there, I think, hanging out that night. He may have been booking that night, actually. And it was a three-way match. And at one point, there was one fan in the front row who was really, like, engaged in the show.
Lupus, for those who don't remember, was part of the, like, last version of Raven's Nest in ECW.
That's right, with Chastity.
Yeah, with Chastity. And then when TNA did their ECW reunion pay-per-view, they had a fake Lupus for some reason in a skit who I believe was Sam Shaw, I think.
No, okay.
Yeah, that was I think it was Sam Shaw because I remember I think I talked to him about it. Yeah, because I know whoever it was, I think I talked about it. So it was Sam Shaw. So yeah, Samuel Shaw, who went from being, you know, skateboarder guy to fake Lupus to Patrick Bateman type serial killer gimmick. He was the fake. Yeah. So he was a fake Lupus. So go on.
Well, there was a fan at ringside who at some point during it's on the tape, throws a karate kick at someone. I can't even remember who he did, but it was like a high karate kick. And you hear next to me was Madonna Wayne Gacy, who was Twiggy's manager, although wasn't managing that night. And you hear him say, did he just throw a karate kick? Like a high, like head level karate kick. And then during the match,
it was actually a good karate kick.
It was amazing. I got to watch this now. I haven't seen it in years. And then during the match, they bring a ladder into the ring and Lupus is going to dive onto his two opponents on the floor. And as he dives, the ladder gives way and he just does a complete header right head first straight down to the floor. It was brutal. He ended up getting helicoptered to a hospital. I don't remember where the hospital was and we all went there, but it was a real serious deal.
Now, I know he stopped wrestling, but, I mean, did he end up being okay?
He seemed, other than the fact that it was such a nasty thing and he was bleeding and he was swollen, he seemed like happy and okay in the hospital when we saw him before they were going to take him back. But
and then he disappeared from wrestling forever.
Yeah, I don't think he ever wrestled. I think his name was Kent Porter, I want to say was his real name. Nice guy.
But he didn't get paralyzed or anything.
Not that I remember at all, no. I don't know.
Good, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe better than the unknown fate of PB Diaz Dos.
But you're assuming it's PB Diaz Dos. We don't know.
The second PB.
Well, it could be the fifth PB. We don't know. We just know
he's not the original.
We just know he's not the original.
So it could be PB Diaz Diaz.
He's the watered down PB Diaz.
Somehow it reminds me of this. It's The Simpsons where Mo talks about being in the Little Rascals.
I don't know.
And he beats up Alfalfa and then someone runs out and he's like, oh my God, you killed the original Alfalfa. I don't know why that made me think.
Yeah, either do I. But
because it's not even the original PBJS.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we will try to do our research and find out exactly what happened here. And
we're gonna try to get him on the show.
We're going to try to get this PBJS on the
show. And we're going to try to get a PBJS on the show. One of them.
We're going to get an Argentinian phone book and just look for Diaz, Pibe. I was also thinking of, because have you ever seen the Charlie Manson clip of Charlie Manson from AAA when he got hurt falling off a ladder?
Oh, yeah, a long time ago.
He didn't land on his head, though, but he landed badly because it was like a ladder being tipped over and he was supposed to land on, stack table type things, and then but they were way too far, right?
Yeah.
Not fun. And then was it you that was showing me, or did we talk about this? Like the wrestler deaths like list countdown.
We did see that on YouTube last week. It was linked after the PB Diaz video.
Okay, so we talked about it after. Oh, no, we talked about when we were watching PB Diaz. Oh, so it was Sunday, I think, after Between the Sheets that we saw it. That was interesting. I think it had the usual. I mean, it didn't show deaths. I mean, it had photos of Sangre. No, wait, not is it Sangre India that was the wrestler who died with the tope and doing the tope, missing the tope or whatever.
I'm not sure.
Oh no, but and then we found out it wasn't missing a tope. Like photos of him, and then I think there was a thing about Owen Hart where they used a still from the Vic Grimes New Jack thing because of course they did.
Oro.
Fun times all around.
Yeah. It was a wrestling snuff film.
Jesus. Oh, well. So let's move on, I guess.
Good idea.
WWE Network this week, they were moving that direction a little bit, but I guess all of a sudden now is becoming what we actually wanted WWE Network to be, it seems.
Well, I mean, we'll see. I don't subscribe anymore. I canceled that a long time ago, and it's going to take a lot to get me to come back, but it sounds like they just added random shows. I mean, the NWA, they added, I guess, some weeks consecutive.
Well, okay, yeah. So they added NWA World Championship Wrestling, Crockett Era from TBS, a bunch of shows from 85 to 87. And then last night, well, we're recording this Tuesday, so the Monday night this week, they added, like, not long after Raw, they added, like, 4 episodes of Mid-South from 84 and 4 episodes of Smoky Mountain from 94.
But not in order.
Yeah, with gaps. But when I was talking to a friend of mine, Mike, about this, he said that it looks like because when they uploaded the Nitros from 98, they did do it kind of haphazardly like that, and then eventually the gaps got filled in.
We'll see. I'm not going to have any faith that they're going to, you know, put.
I don't have faith in
every week until they actually do it.
After they, like, because with World Class, besides that they stopped dead. They also skipped episodes that we knew they had, I believe.
Right.
Right? So,
and they mislabeled at least one episode, I remember.
Of Crockett, too. They mislabeled.
Really?
They mislabeled, I think, a February 86 videos, February 85, you know, before they were on TBS. So,
you know what sucks, too? They don't include any of the local interviews. It's just the actual show for, you know, like Mid-South.
Well, no, with Mid-South, though, that's how the master tapes are. That's how the tapes that the Watts family has. Like, if you bought something from them when they were selling shows, they didn't have any local promos.
Right, but I'm assuming, based on what we know was in that collection, that local promos existed on separate tapes.
Yeah, but you'd have to locate it. But, I mean, WWE, like, on Classics On Demand, they would include local promos if they were on the tape, at least.
Like, okay.
Because like, you would occasionally get, if it was a bicycle tape, instead of having it on a separate reel, they would just dub over Newtown's promos, so that you'd get, like for AWA, it was, like, some random, like, North Dakota tank town, because it was, like, you know, whatever, the sixth or seventh or eighth town that got the tape or whatever, you know, airing months later, and then, like, they'd show some Crockett shows, which maybe had, like, Knoxville local promos when they, or something like that, or from that area when Flair and Mulligan were doing their thing with help from Crockett. So their history on Classics On Demand at least shows that if there are local promos, they might be including them. But who knows how much is, like, I would think, like, the local promo reels would be the last thing they'd prioritizing.
You know, when I think about my Mid-South collection, that's,
well,
like,
we know for a fact
that's the big thing I want to save is, like, all those promos. I just want to get all of those.
Well, yeah, and your collection of the stuff that was taped off TV, too, is that I was thinking about right. that even if we have stuff, like, from the Master in better quality, I do want to, yeah, we really need all those local promos.
Right.
And you have, your stuff starts 80, like, mid-84?
Early 84. Early I think 84, it starts February 84 to the end.
Close to the end, yeah.
Yeah. To the Crockett buyout.
Oh, you don't have from after the Crockett buyout?
I may have some stuff here and there, but I don't think it was part of that collection. I think I got it separately.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, because we know for a fact that the local promos were on separate wheels with them. I mean, it was with a lot of promotions too.
Right.
I mean, either way, it's cool to see the stuff on the network, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see it in as good a quality as you can see it, with the music all edited out, of course.
We'll always complain about that. I want to know how much it costs. I mean, I guess in the network economy, though, it's probably something that's more realistic than it would have been on the DVD sets, that they should do it.
Yeah, and to me, it's really important, especially for 84 to 85, because that's really where, not just WWF, but obviously at Mid-South doing their music videos and stuff, it's where wrestling really tried to reach that young MTV audience. Right. And music was a major part of that.
And World Class, too. And
World Class, too. Yeah.
ECW, I almost feel like, loses the most because...
Yeah.
Maybe because it's not necessarily as good without it. It, like, literally isn't. You know what I mean?
No, you're right about that. I agree with you on that.
But it's just such a big part of it. Like, I really, like, I'm thinking about, like, some of the stuff's on the network, but, and I was thinking about rewatching because I was... The other day, I wanted to watch the, November to Remember 94, era stuff. Then I remembered, A, it's not on the network, which is, that's through no fault of WWE's because, the masters for those episodes either got damaged or disappeared for that period. Because I think those were some, that got skipped over also when they did the British DVDs, that company that, was part of the bankruptcy and there were issues with or something, Delta, I think. But then I realized, the thing I really want to see, which is the Sandman, Tommy Dreamer type of negative video, it would be dubbed over. And that's probably might be the single greatest DCW music video, too.
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting topic right there.
Should we talk about it?
Well, there was Mikey Whipwreck, Loser by Beck. There was What a Man for Mr. Hughes by Salt and Pepper.
Whipwreck, Say It Ain't So.
I really liked Sandman and Woman, Lenny Kravitz, Let Love Live. Is that the song?
When is that from, earlier in 94?
It's from 94. I don't remember exactly when.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Let Love Rule, excuse me. I think that's the song.
And what else? I mean, that, of course, every November Rain.
Every New Jack match. I'm glad I don't have to hear Desperado. That's the only one I'm really, really happy about.
But that, I feel like, is the of if at least not counting November Rain, because that's not really a feud or wrestler video. I feel like that the typo negative Christian Woman video is the best one they ever did.
Oh, who had a Elastica connection?
Oh, Mikey. That was another. Mikey had the best video.
Yeah, really. Mikey was watching 120 minutes or something.
Well, the thing I loved about it too, when I wrote that thing in Figure Four earlier in the year about music, it was perfect too for Mikey. All those song choices fit Mikey, and even the evolution of the character. You know what I mean? And just the tone of them.
Yeah.
Just that it's, you go from Loser and then Connection when he's now more of kind of a legitimate wrestler. And it's kind of got a little bit more of an edge. And then Say It Ain't So for the Sandman feud.
I remember talking to him one night at the hotel bar after one of those shows. And he was, I assume he was pretty drunk. And someone must have told him I had wrestling tapes. And he started harassing me, but in a very rude way that I didn't want to help him. The only thing he wanted to see, he was obsessed with one thing. He was like, I need every episode of the Bobby Heenan show. That's the only thing I care about. And, I would try to make a small talk. I'm like, oh, you mean the Oinkettes? I'm like, no, listen to me. Listen carefully. I need every episode of the Bobby Heenan show. Okay. nice meeting you. Take it easy.
I think, I'm trying to figure out, did I ever meet him other than, I met him at, where did you go to this, the Long Island Comic and Card Show, whatever it was, where John Arezzi had his last gasp at a convention, sort of?
I don't think so, no.
It was in 94, it was December 94.
And no, I definitely wasn't there.
He had Foley, who was joined by Mikey, and Missy, and there were some some wrestling-themed, merch dealers and stuff there for one small section of it. It was in the Nassau Coliseum convention center thing.
No, I went to one that summer at the Nassau Community College gym that had Bruno Sammartino. Okay. And actually that's the only time I ever met Herb Abrams. Herb Abrams was there.
what was that like?
Bruno was, very classy, and that was when he was doing the thing, which he did for years, where he wouldn't charge for autographs. He would sign everything because he thought it was insulting fans if he charged. So then there would be other people would sell 8x10s and stuff. And the people that were there were longtime, lifelong Bruno people. Georgie Ann Macropoulos, who had been the president of Bruno's fan club, who had played a big part in WWF history because she was the one who, trying to remember the exact story the way I heard it, Buddy Rogers' wife, because she was the head of the Buddy Rogers fan club too, revealed to Georgie Ann that Buddy and his crew were going to walk out. And then Georgie Ann let Vince Sr. know, and that's what led to Vince Sr. forcing the Bruno title change right away.
Really?
Yeah.
Jim, I did not know.
Jim Cornette knows more about this because me and him have had discussions about it. But Georgie Ann was there. Mike Madugno was there, who had taken over from Georgie Ann. He was her boyfriend, and then they broke up, I think. And then years later, they still remained friends. He took over the Bruno fan club. Dominic Valente was there. So, it was that whole old 60s, 70s WWF crowd were there with Bruno. And, you know, I remember I asked Bruno, it's on video somewhere. I was a kid. I was like, you know, do you think you'll ever get into the WWF Hall of Fame? And he's like, this is the only Hall of Fame that matters. The people, whatever he said, you know. And then all of a sudden, Herb Abrams showed up with some tall blonde who was his girlfriend. And I tried to talk to him. He was a bit all over the place. He didn't seem especially coked up. I think he was just, you know, normal Herbo. You know, the Power Twins used to call him Herbo Turbo. Whenever I would talk to the Power Twins, they would call him Herbo Turbo. And he was there, and his girlfriend had a Bruno Sammartino LJN that she brought. They had Bruno sign.
Oh, so I brought that up anyway because I just remember this, Mikey, like, I remember my dad noticing, like, it does me, or does it look like Mikey had fresh gig marks on him? And then I learned that it was the night before when Paul Loria had made his big return and attacked Mikey, and Mikey gigged.
I thought that was great, by the way, the Paul Loria, Mikey Whipwreck thing. That was when MSG first started airing ECW.
Yes, and Loria was really good. They had good matches.
Yeah, they really did. Well, they trained together.
I know,
so they
but
knew
still.
Really,
but,
they had really good matches, yeah.
And then Loria just kind of disappeared forever.
Yeah.
I mean, he did help Mikey run his wrestling school later.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they had a promotion somewhere, like, I guess, in Suffolk County.
I met him that summer also at a show at the Nassau Coliseum in 95, and he was a really nice guy. Really, really cool.
Paul Loria?
Yeah.
Not nicer than Drunk Mikey?
No, Drunk Mikey was kind of a dick. Paul Loria was there, and one of my friends who I was one of my tape trading friends, who was a good friend of mine for a long time, Eric Benben. Eric could tend to be obnoxious at times, and I like Eric, but he could. And he just kept, as I'm talking to Paul Loria about wrestling, Eric was talking to him too, but everything Eric said was like a joke about being short. And Paul Loria, just to his credit, just smiled, laughed, and you know, tried not to let that ruin everything. But every single thing he said was, you know, so tell me the long and the short of it about this.
Well, his gimmick, to be fair.
Well, still. The guy doesn't need to be shoved in his face nonstop that he's 5'4".
That may be generous. So we're talking about the WWE Network. I don't know if there's anything else to talk about with that. I mean, I'm glad to see them putting more stuff up. I hope they do. I mean, it's
they keep sending me emails, and it's time to restart your subscription. They haven't realized yet that it doesn't help them when they send me an email with a giant picture of Roman Reigns, like, your subscription, you restart your subscription now. It's like, you know what? No, I'm waiting for them to beg. I'm waiting for them to offer me something. And then I'll think about it, but I'm not going to do it. I fear that my girlfriend's going to get one of those 3-month WWE Network cards as like a gift and give them to me, and I'm going to have to join up. But
well, don't they only have those at Kmart or Walmart or something?
I don't know. I just heard about them. I don't know where they're distributed.
I mean, I think it's something like that. So I mean, you may be in the clear. I think it's some sort of weird exclusive deal.
The only thing I was really enjoying on there was I was watching in order 1986 Primetime Wrestling. And it's not that I forgot. I feel like Monsoon and Heenan were really good then, better than maybe they were later on, even though I enjoyed them later on. But in 86, when they were first getting going as a team, it was really, really enjoyable.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. So what were we? I don't even.
good segue, Bix. Good job.
I got distracted by my phone.
Shiny?
Yeah, I mean, it was very shiny. I mean, it seems like the original shows have gotten a lot better, though, which is something. But it's the whole self-fulfilling prophecy thing. They think not enough people watch the old stuff, but they didn't give much variety. And then the shows they had up early, you know, that were not in order and blah, blah, blah. So it's stupid, and they may still not understand how binge watching works. So I don't know. I mean, I'm somewhat hopeful, but like we said earlier, I would not be shocked if they just put up a few and then just stopped. I don't know.
That's what I expect. Until they show me otherwise, that's exactly what I expect.
Yep. I mean, in the meantime, everyone go subscribe to nwaclassics.com. Give Bruce Tharp your money because
what have they put up recently?
Let's see. I mean, there's been some interesting stuff that went up. Some of it I need to catch up on. I'm just trying to think, because, like, what was the last thing? A bunch went up since, like, the Gino Hernandez Harley Race match. Like, that's one of the things on the main page, because they have all the world title matches listed. But let's see if I click on matches. Let's see what they have. So, the most recent uploads, we got Tony Atlas versus Kamala, Wrestling 2 and Magnum Ta. Midnight Express.
That's probably good.
Yeah. Debbie Combs versus Donna Day. Andre and Duggan against Kamala and Missing Link.
Wow. So that's 83 right before Andre stopped doing tours. Wow.
Yeah. Midget match with Ivan the Terrible in Little Tokyo against Little Lone Eagle. I don't know who that is. Cowboy Lang. Butch Reed versus Marty Lundy. Pre-Arn Anderson, Arn Anderson. Nick Bockwinkel versus Dusty Rhodes. Nick Bockwinkel versus Chavo Guerrero. Ted DiBiase versus Magnum TA. Ernie Ladd and Butch Reed versus Terry Taylor and Sonny King. A lot of interesting stuff. Most of it's Mid-South era. I know that Bruce Tharp, like, he wants to maybe see if he could put up some of the older stuff, but he's just putting up what he's getting from the company that's doing the digital conversion for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's all 83, 84 right there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're just doing it in whatever order they're doing it, and maybe all that stuff's kind of together. You got just all sorts of stuff. Savannah Jack versus Sting.
Wow, really? That's interesting.
Two versus Magnum TA.
We talked about how, I don't remember if it was last week's show or this week when we were both on, you as the host and me as the guest on Between the Sheets, but we talked about how IWCCW aired two episodes of the UWF from December of 86, yep, randomly in, I think, 92.
Which was also so notable that PWI actually mentioned it, I think, in the year-end issue.
That's right. Well, I went on a Vicious Vincent bus trip right around that time.
Would this be to Halloween Havoc?
It was either to the Meadowlands or Halloween Havoc. Mm-hmm. The Meadowlands show is interesting. So I go on a Vince Russo. Vicious Vincent is Vince Russo's radio personality, in case anyone didn't know that. I go on this Vicious Vincent bus trip. And we go to the Meadowlands show, and it's, I want to say, the beginning, maybe the first week of October 1992, Meadowlands Arena. And it's very funny in retrospect, because on the show is Jeff Jarrett. So I'm thinking, this is the first time Vince Russo ever saw Jeff Jarrett. Huh. Right? I mean, he wasn't watching USWA.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
So that's the first time he ever saw Jeff Jarrett at that show. And he went backstage before the show, and he got an interview, like, in gimmick with Razor Ramon, both of them in gimmick.
I do kind of remember.
Yeah. So, but what was I saying? I was saying, oh, so I went on one of those bus trips. It may have been Halloween Havoc. And I just watched these two episodes of IWCCW with 1986 UWF. And I knew so many of those people, Ted DiBiase, Sting. I mean, I knew so many of them, but there were people I didn't know. So I asked Vicious Vincent, he was taking questions and answer on a bus. I said, whatever happened to Savannah Jack and Eli the Eliminator? And he had no idea who I was talking about. He goes, they're working at a 7-Eleven somewhere. And that was the answer I got.
The Matt Rat didn't know either.
No, the Matt Rat didn't know. They were busy. It was so weird. You get on the bus trip, and you could tell they just got a bunch of stuff from WWF. And they would walk on the bus and kind of they would be dejected. They would walk around just handing everyone, like, the press photos for, like, the Bushwhackers. Not signed or anything, but just, like, here's 8x10 pictures of the Bushwhackers. It's like, thanks. What am I supposed to do with this?
How would you explain to someone who never heard it? Do you have any tapes of this?
I do. I have plenty of tapes of Vicious.
You need to digitize these. You really do. Because
I may have to.
So how would you explain? You can probably explain it better than me. How would you explain Brian from Long Beach, the Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling?
Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling was really cool if you were a kid who hadn't really discovered the Observer yet. I was 12 years old when I started listening to it in the summer of 92, and it was cool. It was Friday nights from 6 to 8 on the radio on Long Island.
So wait, had you never heard a Rezzy show at that point?
I had never heard a Rezzy show. I had somehow – my father read about it in the paper, and I would try to wake up in the middle of the night and listen to Rich Mancuso. So I heard that show, but I had never heard a Rezzy. And – I knew about Vicious Vincent because it was in the Slammer column, I think. I think that's how I found out about it. It was in the Slammer. Blackjack Brown wrote about it. And it was 6 to 8 on Friday nights, 2 hours. And it was Vicious Vincent, his co-host, the Mat Rat, who was his best friend, Jimmy, who I believe he brought with him to WWF, and he got a job in merchandise or something. And the Mat Rat's voice – let me try to do it. My voice is destroyed from doing
that. I can do it if you want me to.
Hot diggity dog. Hey, Vicious Vince.
Yeah, that's right? Pretty much it.
That's pretty much it. And he was like the goody two-shoes. He loved all the baby faces. Vicious Vince loved all the heels. The big thing you would do if you wanted to get in good with Vicious Vincent, and this is funny enough knowing where history goes, is you would call up and you'd go, woo! And then he would do it, and yeah. You'd talk about how great Ric Flair was.
That's right.
That was what you did to get in good with Vicious Vincent. So it's Vicious Vincent, the Mat Rat, and the third person was Skull Von Kruss, who is now Vito LaGrasso. Well, he was Vito LaGrasso, but we didn't know that was his real name yet. And he came
– notable lawsuit plaintiff, Vito LaGrasso.
Right. This is during the period where he was a jobber as stipulated in the Jerry McDivitt filing.
About that, about him, yes.
Yeah, because it was 1992, which is when he was working for them as a job guy. And he was also on Vicious Vincent's side as a heel. And it was a really cool show because, you know, you would get some insider news. UB Marks did the news at the top of the show. And that was
weirdo.
Right. So he would actually give you some real news, and they wouldn't get too inside, but if you were a passionate wrestling fan and young, again, I was 12, you can call up and have something to talk, have someone to talk to about wrestling, and you hear other kids. And when it was 2 hours, you can call in multiple times. And then Vince ran out of money. So right when the school year started, he went from a 2 hour show to a 1 hour show, and it went from Friday nights to Sunday night. Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. And again, if you're a kid getting ready for school, it's not the same feeling as listening to it right before the weekend. You're listening to the end of the weekend, getting ready to go to school. And then he loses UB Marks, and he replaces UB Marks with Blackjack Brown, who was a nice guy, but he sounded like he was half asleep. Like, okay, Vicious Vince, here's the news this week. There's a new tag team in the WWF. It's Jimmy Garvin and someone else. You know, it was just it dropped off a cliff. And then by that point, he was talking to WWF enough that he had a relationship, so they would give him people. So, like, he would have Freddie Blassie on to preview the Survivor Series. And that would eat up half the show because it was now only 1 hour. He switched from 2 hours to 1 hour. And it was just – it would be ungodly bad kayfabe interviews. Johnny B. Badd was his regular guest from WCW. And it was just these total kayfabe interviews. And right around this time – there was a movement amongst fans, and I must say, even though I was a fan of his, and I liked Vince, and I got along with him, and he was at my bar mitzvah hill, but there was a movement amongst fans to hit back, I guess is the best way to put it, against Vicious Vincent. I kind of started it because I had a friend of mine who was a comedian. He was trying to be a comedian. He was 12. But he did a Kermit the Frog voice. Yes. And I said one day, you know, it'd be really funny. Call up this show and say you're Kermit the Frog, and let's hear what kind of reaction you get. And he waited on hold for like 40 minutes, like past, I think, like a Freddie Blassie interview or something, or an interview with the Rosati sisters. I mean, these were the caliber of guests we were getting on the show. And Vicious Vincent finally goes to him and goes, let's go to Jeff in Port Washington. Jeff, are you on the air? And he says, hello, this is Kermit the Frog. And Vince, flush him, because that was Vince's thing. When he didn't like a call, you'd say, flush him, and they'd play a toilet bowl sound, followed by, na, 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 hey, hey, goodbye.
Now, I remember Kermit. Now, I also remember the Tomato Man.
There was the Tomato Man. There was Kermit. Then Yoshi the Green Dinosaur started
Yoshi
calling
the him. Dinosaur, who was always – I couldn't tell if it was just a person or it was a recording.
No, it was a person. I know
who was.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to say the name on the air, but it was a person.
Is it someone that people would know?
No, it's just someone no one would know, but, you know, someone no one needs to know about. He also played the effeminate caller named Hickenbottom. So he started getting these calls, and then it turned into people calling up and playing clips of John Arezzi and just yelling curses. And then it got to the point where Vince wouldn't take calls anymore.
Oh, my God. I didn't remember the clips of John Arezzi.
Oh, yeah. Because someone called up and they played, and you hear the end of the theme music for Wrestling Spotlight, John Arezzi. And the clip went off, and Vince was silent, and Mat Rat goes, what was that?
Oh, my God.
But yeah, we We should take some of those tapes and I don't know if are we legally allowed to just broadcast clips of them?
It's fair use if we do them within the show. So it's fair use. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, we got to air some of those clips of Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling.
Yes, I'm blocked by him on Twitter. Actually, you know what? I know someone that could actually ask him if he considers it okay.
What did you do to get blocked by Vince Russo on Twitter?
Said words. I don't.
Does he block people regularly?
He blocks people for nothing.
Oh.
Yeah.
I also bought when his video store that everyone talks about. Like, yeah, I was the guy who bought all of his wrestling videos when he went out of business.
That's right. So, you went all the way up to Quorum.
Oh, what a dump. Yeah, I went all the way out there, and I went in there, and the things that were remaining, he had, like, some movies, and then he had all of his wrestling stuff and, like, a giant room of porn. And I went in there, and I bought Starrcade 86, Great American Bash 89, Starrcade 87. No, I didn't get Starrcade 86. Crockett Cup 86. Excuse me. I'm all wrong.
If you got Crockett Cup 86, that would have been a hell of a find.
Yeah, Crockett Cup 87, Crockett Cup 88. I got Starrcade 88. I got a whole bunch of stuff. And the funny thing I remember is Starrcade 86 had a sticker on it. And the sticker said, better than WrestleMania 3.
He clearly was a fan of other types of wrestling. So it's hard to figure out how things went the way they did.
Yeah, that's the weird part about it. Yeah. He thought that was better than WrestleMania 3. But then he also had Judy Bagwell, David Arquette. I don't know.
I really, how can you figure him out? I don't know. You know him better than me. Your mom hired him to,
he's a mystery wrapped inside of
bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how much your parents spent on that?
Oh, I know exactly how much. And you know what? We're going to save that for next week.
Yes. Next week, you'll tell the whole story.
Next week, I'll tell that. I don't know about the whole story, but I'll tell that part of the story.
Okay. I'm intrigued now. Because I've heard the bar mitzvah story. I don't think I've ever heard that part of it.
Okay. And now you have something to look forward to. Suspense.
Yes. So I don't even know how we got on that topic.
That's the name of the show.
That's how the show works. Exactly. Here.
Yeah.
Don't complain. They're jumping off points.
See, if you stuck with us past my Black Scorpion, it paid off. It's worth it.
Yeah. So speaking of the Black Scorpion, you wanted to talk about Oli a little bit. Yeah. No.
Yeah. I'm gonna scare you every time I do that voice. Now you're gonna be frightened.
Frightened.
I had a thought because Dave Meltzer seems to be saying now, and correct me where I'm wrong, Bix, because I feel like you follow this stuff more closely than I do. Mm-hmm. That he created the category that got Carlos Colon entered into the Hall of Fame just to get Carlos Colon entered in the Hall of Fame.
To be more fair to Colon, he felt.
Right. And now he's talking about getting rid of the category?
Well, because just about everyone else in it, you can argue, has a perfectly fine candidacy as a historical American candidate.
I don't know. I mean, is it fair to have a category that's Atlanta and Mid-Atlantic? Because, I mean, that's where it gets to me.
But it's technically an American territory. And, I mean, he should have – he always deserved to go in, I felt. But I can see why, because it's just a weird bucket. But then you have him in the same bucket as Australian candidates. So it was weird anyway.
What is your argument for Carlos Colon being in the Hall of Fame?
I think you have to throw in his work as a promoter. For starters, which you kind of do for anyone that has that kind of credentials. But, I mean, he really was a big draw for a long time. And even if he didn't draw anywhere else, I mean, what makes him different from Jerry Lawler?
What makes him different from Big Daddy?
Big Daddy, I don't vote in Europe, even though I probably know more about the European candidates than most voters outside of Europe. But Big Daddy, it's not clear whether or not he was an actual draw or if he's more a star, so to speak.
You say it's not clear. I mean, we don't have attendance numbers.
We don't have records, and I don't agree with Dave about this. Like, Dave's very sour on the idea, in part because, in general, joint promotions didn't really run big buildings. But their business model was, let's run lots and lots of shows, as many as possible. And smaller towns get their shows and blah, blah, blah. So I don't think that's the issue. But, I mean, you don't really know if he was necessarily a much bigger draw than whoever else. Right. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame just because it when you're that degree of star, I think you kind of have to be. But I haven't been voting for him because I haven't been voting for Europe.
I don't know. The whole Hall of Fame, I think about it a lot. I think Ole Anderson should be in. I don't think the Anderson brothers should be in. I think Ole Anderson should be in. And I find it hard to believe that he's not.
I think he should be, yeah. Because, I mean, he really had a strong drawing track record.
Because if the whole argument against him, and I'm not saying it's the whole thing, but it seems to be one that's brought up a lot. It's the one that he brought up to Meltzer in that famed Wrestling Observer Live interview, is that he didn't go places, yet he was a draw and a very important presence in two different territories. Where did Carlos Colon go? I mean, he didn't go anywhere. He was just in Puerto Rico, and everywhere else he went, he flopped.
See, but I think that's an overrated metric because, I mean, Lawler is no doubt a Hall of Famer.
I think it's an overrated metric too, but I'm saying if that's the metric that's used for one, why isn't it used for the other?
Hell if I know.
Well, okay.
But I mean, I think I voted for Colon. I'm glad he went in. I would vote for someone like Anoli as a singular candidate, although, and then he would probably be under Modern because he still had, you know, through the Horseman era and stuff.
Did you have any reservations about voting for Colon considering his role in the cover up of Bruiser Brody's murder?
Oh, because no one else who's deserving in the Hall of Fame has ever done anything like that.
I'm asking about him specifically. We could talk about other candidates as well, or other.
No, or people who are. No, because of the. Because that's just. With someone like. Because I did have said that stuff about Moolah in the past, but that's on top of Moolah being a terrible candidate.
Right.
Like, because. And also because I feel like her awfulness is all. As a human. Is inextricably linked with her Hall of Fame candidacy because her most legitimate candidacy is her wheelings and dealings behind the scenes. And, well, if you really give any scrutiny to it based on what we've heard about her, the idea of rewarding her for that specifically sounds really, really skeevy.
Yes. You know, just a quick aside.
Whereas
I just
with Carlos Colon, you're not if he did help cover up a murder, you're not rewarding him specifically for covering up a murder.
A quick aside to the Moolah part, I just saw online somewhere someone released some of Fred Hornby's notes. And one of the things one of the things I found really interesting was that he had a television listing for 1956. It was the first Vincent McMahon Sr. Washington, D.C. show broadcast into New York. And on the first television show aired was Slave Girl Moolah. So I thought that was interesting, just the idea she was on the very first episode that aired in New York of the McMahon family's wrestling empire.
Wow. Was that the first ever territorial wrestling TV show kind of targeted to New York, too?
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
This is 55, and I mean, there was no one that was taping TV. I mean, there was no one that was taping TV for national TV out of New York, right?
No, there wasn't.
For the New York area. New York-specific shows come before the DC show in New York, like the Sunnyside Gardens and what was the Connecticut show?
I'm not sure.
Bridgeport? I think it was Bridgeport.
That sounds about right, yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to find that. But that is interesting that she went back that far with them.
Yeah, the very first episode. So I saw that. I was like, oh, that explains something. I don't know
what. Hornby stuff.
I saw it on Wrestling Classics. Someone
on the main board or the Luthez sub.
I want to say it was the Luthez one. Someone had a rest in peace Fred Hornby, and while going down it, there were a bunch of Fred Hornby. You know, someone typed up some notes of his. Hmm. Yeah, so check that out. It's interesting stuff. But back to the thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm just so sour on Carlos Colon as a human being because of all that. And I know you kind of have to separate the two when it comes to the Hall of Fame, but you know, especially after reading Tony Atlas's book recently, and you know. I don't know. There was so much shady shit going on there. And the one thing that can't be argued is that they tried to portray Jose Gonzalez as, you know, Mr. Nice Guy on TV.
No, he already was a babyface before, to be fair.
However, he was on trial for murder, and they did everything they could to use their television to position him into being a sympathetic figure.
But a lot of the stuff people cite was stuff he was doing before he killed Brody. I mean, you can say he killed Brody because he admitted he killed Brody. He just said it was self-defense. But
you know, like the just being a babyface. He already was a babyface. The say no to drugs stuff with no Drew Gus on the back of his trunks. That was something he did before he killed Brody. So, I mean, that's. I mean, obviously, it was with that goal in mind, but it's not that it's having never seen the TV myself, the way I've always heard it described doesn't sound nearly as bad in that context as you'd think.
I had always heard it described the other way. And again, I hadn't seen the TV either. I'd never really sought out Puerto Rico TV, especially that period. I certainly wouldn't want to watch. It would make my stomach turn. But that's always what I heard. So I don't know. But going back to the bigger argument, I feel like if Carlos Colon is a Hall of Famer for what he did in Puerto Rico, then other people who worked similar size areas should be considered as well.
If they, well, it's not a big area, but he, none of them would have drew on the level of crowds he did, though, consistently.
Not that level, but Ole Anderson was a consistent draw for, what, 10 years? 12 years?
Depending on how we're counting him, I mean, and what time period. I mean, when did the Andersons really break through, like in the Carolinas? Like 68, 69?
I wasn't sure. Was it that early? Because it was Gene and Lars before it was Gene and Ole.
Right, because it was Gene and Lars first, but I'm not sure when Ole was part of it, started teaming with Gene. It was early 70s at the latest, like 70, 71 maybe.
Here's another question for you about the Hall of Fame. And we're not going to turn this into a whole Hall of Fame show. We'll just leave it at this and we'll revisit it. But looking back now, that original Hall of Fame class from 96, I believe, mm-hmm. Does Ted DiBiase belong in there?
No.
That's what I feel too.
Now, it was a weird – especially – I mean, I'm trying to figure out if him already having his career being over – like, was there – does it make him a better candidate or worse candidate? Because, like, him and – I mean, Steamboat did come back for a few matches years later, but both of them were very retired. And, like, I've seen Steamboat mention. Steamboat, I feel like, should be – is not a – maybe he shouldn't have been first class, but I don't think Steamboat stands out the way DiBiase does in a bad way. And nothing against DiBiase, but you know what I mean.
Well, here's my question. DiBiase's a Hall of Famer. I guess – I'm just guessing you would have to say it's based on 80, 81 to 89, 88, right? You think that's fair?
Yeah, maybe even 90, but sure. Or you could, I could say 90, 91 because you got the Virgil stuff and the Dustin Rhodes.
Okay.
Stuff, yeah, but.
So it's based on his WWF run as the Million Dollar Man, which is, you know, one of the gimmicks that people who are casual fans know.
And Mid-South and Georgia pretty much.
It's based on his Mid-South run and UWF run.
And All Japan.
See, All Japan,
he was never that good in All Japan.
No, he wasn't. I mean, I know he was Stan Hansen's partner and they had success in terms of winning tournaments and stuff, but in terms of great matches, I never thought DiBiase was a really good fit there.
You'd think he would be.
You would think.
You would think he would work well with Jumbo and those guys. You would think he would be a good fit with that style, but he never really was.
But I guess my issue is if he's in there primarily because he was a great worker, which I think is the argument for his inclusion in there. For that period of time, again, it's not a 20-year period of time. It's basically, even if you want to go a little bit earlier, if you want to say 78 to 88 or 78 to 90, whatever you, 91. But I think that raises the issue of other people.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Who are like Barry Windham, for instance. And I'm not saying Barry Windham.
I feel like Barry Windham should be in if just for work.
See, I'm not sure. I'm up in the air about
it. Well, I think if you're opening that door, I think he should be.
If you're opening that door, Barry Windham was top as good as there was for, you know, at least until early 89, right? I guess that would be the end of it.
And you could argue in 1988 he was the best worker in the world.
You absolutely could. And quite frankly, he was just as good in 87. It's just he was a babyface and he didn't have the same position on the cards.
Right.
Because like one of the most underrated feuds that no one talks about, everyone talks about Midnight Express versus Rock and Roll, Midnight versus Fantastics. Midnight against Ron Garvin and Barry Windham mm-hmm. is probably my favorite. I mean, it didn't last a long time, but it was great. It had heat, had great angles where Cornette burned Ron Garvin. And then Jimmy Garvin turns babyface and charges into the dressing room and tackles Cornette. I feel like that's like the underrated Midnight Express feud of that time. And Barry Windham in there against Bobby Eaton was just great stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it opens that door for, like, you know, a bunch of guys like that who were great workers for the same period of time that Ted DiBiase was a great worker.
And then there's the whole Red Bastine thing where it's like, you see, this is where I think if you go by his legacy as a worker, since we only have like one or two matches, he probably should be in because they talk about him as being like one of the very best guys in the business. You know what I mean? To an extreme, like, you know, Chris Benoit, Kenta Kobashi, Daniel Bryan, although Bryan didn't go in this yet, type of degree. So I think if that's the case, he should be in. But I'm, you know, it got people who haven't seen him aren't necessarily going to know that.
I can't say anything because I've never really seen Red Bastine.
Right. Just, you know, that one AWA tag match, really, and maybe like one or two like black and white matches.
Yeah. Not enough to really comment. But anyway, as I said, I don't want to turn this into a whole Hall of Fame thing. This is a topic we will revisit from time to time as the weeks go by. But I know I wanted to talk about something else, Bix. You had recently gone through a bunch of Steve Beverly's Mat Watch, which, for those of you who don't know, was, I guess it would be in the top three. It was the Observer, the Torch, and Mat Watch. And Mat Watch may be number two during that time where it was in operation in terms of inside newsletters.
Yeah, Matwatch was kind of considered the number two, but it had its own niche because of the TV focus and all that. But I would say my gut says that during the time it was in operation, maybe not during 91 when Steve started to, you know, kind of getting ready to walk away and when Dave really ramped things up with the Observer. But I would say from like 88 to 90, you could make a strong argument it was the best of the newsletters.
Well, how would you, for the people who don't know, how would you describe Mat Watch and tell us a little bit about it?
Okay, so it's a little more formatted the way Torch was. Like, it's not like The Observer, which is just, you know, text, here's a section, whatever. It's more like The Torch where you've got sections and an attempt at design, even if haphazardly with cutting and pasting and all that. And when I say cutting and pasting, I mean literal cutting and pasting. Before he got it, you know, professionally printed. And the idea was to kind of focus on wrestling on TV because Steve Beverly was a TV news guy and all that, and he had connections. So, you know, ratings were covered each week. I mean, now that I'm looking at this, is probably, I mean, Dave did cover ratings in The Observer, but this is probably the best resource for ratings. Not probably, it is the best resource for wrestling ratings during the period that it was around. Lots of stories from the TV side that you wouldn't, you know, that you wouldn't hear from other newsletters. And, you know, just it's easy to find stuff just because of the way he kind of formatted it. And he would review, he wouldn't do like a written up review, but he'd list the results in the segments and give a, you know, a score and all that to each wrestling show that week. And between this, you know, satellite dish and tapes, he tried to or did watch just about everything. So it's just a really cool resource. I'm just trying to think. Like, other
and he also, you know, I know from when I first started watching NWA in 89, he was one of the people on the wrestling hotline.
Well, yeah, that too. And he had very good relations with WCW.
With Jim Herd?
I think before, maybe even predating that and then because of that. And he had, you know, so it's such a different world when you look back and you see like these on the record interviews with Jim Herd in the newsletters. You know?
Yeah.
Like, could you, what's the equivalent of that now?
That's hard to say, actually.
I mean, because you don't have you don't even have WCW, but I mean, it's, you know, doing like a straight up just newsletter interview. I mean, it's like, would it be me? Because I mean, you don't even have a Jim Herd type thing.
It doesn't translate as well now for a lot of different reasons.
Like, if it was someone in WWE, you could make an easier analogy.
It'll be like an on the record interview with Kevin Dunn.
That's close, yeah.
Yeah.
And
so,
it's just a really good newsletter.
I know you've been going through Mat Watches and a couple things you had mentioned to me that you came across.
And I tweeted a little bit of it too. Yeah.
And you tweeted a little bit at David Bix. Go check him out. Say hello. He loves hearing from his fans. A couple of things you mentioned and I wanted to talk about on the air were one of them was I guess he wrote something about the wrestling show on Morton Downey Jr., which we had talked about last week in the first episode of the series. What did he say exactly?
He had talked to Dennis Corluzzo, who was on that show, about how Dennis had been assured by the producers that Captain Lou Albano and Tony Altamar, or who I don't even remember being on it. I don't remember Altamar being on.
He was. He wasn't on the panel, but he was in the crowd like with other people, and eventually he got to one of the little podiums with a microphone.
Okay, that's right. And he was assured they wouldn't be on it, but then they were because Morton Downey Jr. insisted. And so this is probably, because I'm going through these because these are like in reverse order, so I had to, like, as I'm, this is, it seems like it's only a couple weeks after it happened, so this is like summer 89, I guess. And what Beverly then notes is that the show's been canceled, so that's probably one of the last episodes.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, because he was canceled like instantly, wasn't he, over the fake Nazi attack thing?
He was, but the reason I'm not sure is I could be wrong in my timeline, but I believe after this episode aired, there was a second episode, or not a second episode, but there was a different episode about bounty hunters. Live from Atlantic City.
That also had Dr. D. David Schultz.
And had David Schultz on, and they, you know, they were kind of, they talked a little bit, or they showed a little bit that they knew each other already. They already had met each other. So that tells me that came after this one.
Well, actually, now that you think about it, this is 80.
And Atlantic City, I believe, is where the alleged, the faux swastika incident happened. It happened okay, there.
So maybe it's this trip. Because, I mean, maybe. The other thing, though, I'm trying to figure out is, wouldn't the wrestling episode was when Heyman was with WCW then?
No, I think it was before he went
that's
to
WCW. That's what didn't make sense to me. But then he had been in WCW. If I'm right that this was like...
Well, here's the other thing, too. 89. He wasn't... No, I think the episode was 88 for a number of reasons.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. But he came in around like November 88. So why would Dennis be talking to him about this months later?
I'm not sure, but Morton Downey, unless I'm wrong, was still on the air when he appeared in Piper's Pit at WrestleMania 5.
Right, but this is after that.
Huh. That is interesting.
But, yes, so Morton insisted. And did you see the Morton Downey documentary?
I loved it. Oh, I loved it. It was on Netflix for a while. It may still be. I'm not sure, but I love that documentary.
Yeah, it was weird because CNN was hyping it so much, but it's like a several-year-old documentary.
Yeah.
So was it on Netflix before it was on CNN?
I believe so.
I didn't know it existed.
I didn't even know it was on CNN.
Yeah, CNN made this big to-do about airing it a few months ago with the television premiere or whatever. But
oh, then it was definitely on Netflix way before that.
Yeah. I mean, it's very good, though.
Yeah, I saw it like 2 years ago, so it was on Netflix well ahead of that.
The reviews weren't great. I mean, it's not an epically great documentary, but it's very entertaining. It's an interesting look at Morton Downey Jr. I was surprised that it got such kind of relatively negative reviews.
I think if you're from the Northeast, it has a little, it's probably more enjoyable because it's, you know, it's local Channel 9, it's Al Sharpton when he first got prominence.
Right, the Tawana Brawley scandal has more meaning to you because that was a decent chunk of the documentary.
Correct.
So, I mean, even though it was a national show and it did become a big deal nationally, I mean, it's a more of a New York thing.
Right. Well, moving away from this brief foray into Morton Downey Jr. world, one other thing you mentioned that you saw in there, which I find incredibly fascinating, is I guess what AWA's original Team Challenge series concept was.
Okay. Right. So I'm looking through this. And I'm like, oh, my God. So the Team Challenge series was not as stupid as we thought, at least in theory. The basic idea was – and it – couldn't really tell if it was Vern's idea or if it was the syndicator or whatever, that to try to, as kind of a last gasp and get the syndicated show into more markets and all that, they would do the Team Challenge series. But the idea was it for it to be a less of a straight pro wrestling concept and more like American Gladiators and Roller Games, which were starting up that season, that coming season, so, you know, fall 89. And, you know, Roller Games really did not become a hit, but, I mean, that's really neither here nor there.
Although it was great.
And American Gladiators was. That's kind of the vibe they're going for. Kind of like it's pro wrestling, but it's more of one of these action sports entertainment properties. And that was the idea. And Piper was going to be one of the team captains, which I think we knew, right? Because
I didn't know that. No,
because I feel like Chris and I talked about it maybe on a Between the Sheets that Piper had been hyped, or maybe we did some other show we did that Piper had been, because it was Zabiska. So yeah, instead of Baron von Raschke, that it was Piper as like the California something or the West Coast something. But then, you know, Piper resigned with WWF. But yeah, that was the basic idea, and there would also be some kind of profit-sharing deal with the stations.
That's interesting. So Piper, around the same time, was negotiating with AWA, NWA, and WWF?
That's right, because he was negotiating with Herd, too.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
But I mean, the AWA didn't have money, so I wonder
right. What
exactly they had to compel him with, also to the point that they named him in the proposal. Although it's Vern, so that's he was not above doing such things.
Yeah, you know, this is actually the first AWA I ever saw, because it was on the Team Challenge series was on Sports Channel here in New York. Mm-hmm. So this was the very first stuff I saw of the AWA.
On ESPN, yeah. I don't know.
I didn't see it on ESPN, though. I only saw it on Sports Channel.
Well, and it was a lot of the same shows, I think, too. I don't think I ever saw any pre-Team Challenge series stuff either while it was going on that I remember. And later, you know, when they started, after ESPN show got canceled, when they were still keeping some of their syndicated slots, and New York was one of them for some reason on Sports Channel, and they started airing old stuff, like old stuff, like 80s stuff and 70s stuff with Nick Bockwinkel selling insurance and all that.
I don't remember that, unfortunately.
Don't remember Nick Bockwinkel talking about his insurance sales career?
No, I wish I did.
Yeah, I guess some of those are around now. But like, if you look on YouTube, the version that was airing in the Twin Cities, someone has clips of the program they shot for Destruction Crew versus Wahoo and Greg feud on small, like, death knell house shows, where the Destruction Crew were magically champions again, and they shot angles in the wraparounds with Greg and the Destruction Crew and Bischoff. I don't think Wahoo was part of it, where they just set up this upcoming show at a high school or something from like late 90, early 91. But yeah, so what do you think of this interpretation then, I guess, is the way to put it, of the Team Challenge series concept?
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly nothing like it came off.
You can sort of see glimpses of it now. Yeah, you know it. Yeah.
It's, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to know when they realized that there was no hope anymore. I mean,
I'm guessing stations didn't really buy into it, and they realized they didn't have any money anyway.
Yeah, I mean, no one bought into it, it sounds like.
Into the idea that, we'll get profit sharing or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, but they still had the idea, though, so I'm just trying to think. Did we get it on Sports Channel before the Team Fallon series, like, or was this actually when we started getting it?
I don't know. That was the only time I saw it on Sports Channel.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Because that was my introduction to Eric Bischoff and the Destruction Crew and UConn John Nord. Mike George.
The timekeeper
Mike George, which I actually thought was cool when I was a kid.
Mike George was good.
Well, let's not go crazy.
He was a good wrestler. Maybe not at that point as much. Yeah. But.
No, I actually enjoyed that gimmick more than I ever did his wrestling earlier on, like when he was in Mid-South.
I don't even remember what the actual gimmick to it was.
He would pick a time, and he had to beat someone within time.
Yeah.
I think that was the timekeeper. But I guess, why would he beat the timekeeper?
You mean when there is a timekeeper?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Just, you know, that's late period AWA for you. It was at the end of I remember Del Wilkes there as the trooper.
Yes. Johnny Stewart as the man, as the proto Chris Candido.
I don't remember that at all.
Well, okay. See, if you watch Johnny Stewart stuff from his AWA run where he's feuding with the world's most wonderful human being, Buck Zumoff.
Ugh. Yeah.
It's like the facial expressions, the hair, it's Chris Candido.
I got to check it out now.
Yeah, like it was like, I don't remember who it was, like if it was Dave Prazak or someone that I talked to about it when I noticed this thing. It was like, yeah. And if you look, he's like, it's just exactly the same. Even the robes. It's Chris Candido. It's like, and he had that cool finisher too, where he did a, what was it, like flying knee, but like horizontal, like a clothesline.
Did he have a girlfriend that would sleep with wrestlers when he wasn't around, or when he was around?
Oh.
Hey, I was friends with Chris, but still. Jesus. Still.
Oh, that's not nice.
No, but you know,
everything always comes back to her.
It does. It does. Is there anything else you want to talk about this week, Bix? Or
I don't know. We've covered a lot and a lot of time. I mean,
I really hope that what comes out of this episode is we get some answers about El Pibe Diaz.
I hope so. I wonder if it's better not knowing.
I feel like there's more of a story that we don't know. How many Pibe Diaz's are there?
Well, also, who's this guy who he's working with that immediately yanks him up?
Yeah. Yeah, obviously his gimmick isn't the medic.
Yeah, I don't know what they knew about concussions in Argentina in 1983. I think he was still doing that.
I know. Yeah, I'm sorry. Anywhere you go, if you do a dive and land head first
and are immediately unconscious
and immediately are stiff and unconscious, you know not to just start ripping the person up violently.
That guy must have been strong too, because he just
those poor children,
like old man strength.
Those poor children just standing there.
No, seriously though, think about how strong that guy just yanks him up.
Yeah.
He yanks his dead weight while he's still in mid-crumble, too.
I like to think that somewhere at home, the first El Pibe Diaz was watching TV, just like, see, you see what happens when you get rid of me and my dancing women? This is what happens. The guy with the antennas crashes onto the floor.
He had to return to his home planet.
He had the beam back up. Yeah, that's actually why he was so stiff. He had left his body and gone back to wherever he came from. El Pibe Diaz. What does that even translate to? What does that mean?
Oh, God. Do you want me to look up? Okay.
No, I'm going to do it right now. Hold on. Okay. Translate. Typing on the thing. El Pibe. Okay. The kid. The kid 10.
Is he supposed to be a 10-year-old kid?
I mean,
that's fucked up.
That's really weird now, because obviously the second El Pibe Diaz,
well, that explains the suspenders and stuff.
But wait, hold on.
The overalls, I mean.
It doesn't explain the dancing women.
Maybe it
explains the children. It explains the children for the second one, because they're kids, and if he's supposed to be a 10-year-old kid wearing antenna, obviously that's why they're doing it as well. But the first guy, I know he's in pink overalls and he's dancing up a storm, but those are like mature, voluptuous Latino women dancing with him. Like, they're not dancing with a 10-year-old boy like that. So I don't know.
Maybe I don't know. Maybe they're school teachers.
Yeah, he brought all of his teachers with him. El Pibe is the kid. The kid 10.
But that's Spanish? So that's what is there a distinction between Pibe and Nino?
I don't know. I don't even, what do I type?
Difference between Pibe and, just type into Google, difference between Pibe and Nino. Scintillating. Scintillating audio.
We get answers here on this program.
Yes.
No, nothing. It's asked me for the difference between Nino and Pine.
Well, I don't, what's the difference between Nino and Pine?
El Nino tied to melting of Antarctica's Pine Island Glacier. that'd be a good wrestler, El Nino.
Well, have you ever seen the Saturday Night Live sketch about El Nino?
No.
Where it's when the storm was happening or about to happen, it's like the Weather Channel, and then it's Chris Farley cutting a wrestling promo as El Nino. It's like, I am El Nino, which is Spanish for the Nino. And then they had and then Jim Brewer comes on as Ric Flair.
I never saw that. No,
I don't think he actually. I don't think he actually talked like Ric Flair. I think he just had the hair and like a robe.
Do you ever see Fridays, the wrestling skit they used to do?
Not on Fridays, no.
Fridays did really the best one. They did it a few times. One of them's on their DVD box set, and another one I
came out.
Yeah, it doesn't hold up as well. There's some cool stuff. There's some cool stuff, like where they have two rabbis who are going to drive through a flaming matzah. Like, that's kind of funny, but showing that
it's a wrestling sketch.
Yeah, the wrestling. I'm just trying to prove that I'm more Jewy than you. The wrestling sketch is. It's like two brothers, like they're in their house and the mother's like, it's breakfast time. And the two brothers come down and they're like acting like a tag team. Like, you know, they're like, I can't even explain it. Like beating each other up and like, you know, just acting like over the top professional wrestlers. It's really, really good. I got to find it. I'll try to get it. We could put it in the playlist if we could find it.
Okay. How does it compare to the Right This Way, Mr. Duty sketches?
See, those are funny. Those are actually funny. But again, I think we're losing our audience. If we haven't lost them already, Bix.
Oh, God. Now, have you ever seen the SNL Tuesday Night Titans sketch?
No.
Okay, so I had no idea this was ever existed until, because I don't think it's ever aired like in reruns or anything. It's from the Billy Crystal season.
Okay, so that's 85.
Yeah. And it's, I'm trying to remember, it's Rich Hall as Vince McMahon. Who was it as Lou Albano? There was a Lou Albano, I think, and I don't remember who.
Jim Belushi?
Maybe.
He was in that cast, and he was a little bigger than the others. That's why I think.
Maybe Jim Belushi, and then Billy Crystal is a midget wrestler named Little Caesar. I don't remember being that good, but it was on like just a like years ago, a compilation of like WWF TV from that era that I got, and it was on there, and. Yeah, I mean, that seems like you wouldn't think of SNL that era doing, like, a, like, now you'd think of them doing a parody of an obscure, like, cable show. I wouldn't, but that doesn't seem like they do it, something they do in 1985. I don't know, it's like, I just think of what would be the equivalent of Tuesday Night Titans in the modern landscape. But I mean, it's just like, they didn't really parody that type of stuff back then, you know what I mean? I mean, it's, I guess, you know, WWF wrestling was big at the time, but... to parody something as specific as TNT.
Did they parody it before Hogan and Mr. T or after? Because that was that same season.
Oh, before they hosted?
Yeah.
I'd have to look it up. I'm not sure.
Because that was the same season. So that would tell you some of that. Yeah, it's weird. SNL back then, I don't want to get off on a whole thing about that, but that was the only time, the Dick Ebersole years, where they didn't really do any political humor. There's no Ronald Reagan, you know. There's not like tons of Ronald Reagan.
Is there a specific reason for that? Like,
no, I think it was just that's where the cast was at the time.
Right. Yeah, and that's an interesting period for that show. Also, people don't realize one of the weird things about that Hogan and T show. They were like the last minute substitute hosts, or
that's right.
Last minute exactly, because it was Steve Landisberg was going to host, then he gets sick, then they bring in Hogan and T, but it's after they've written everything. Or it's late enough that they've decided they don't want to write anything for them, because then Steve Landisberg does a few minutes of stand up on the show because he's not sick anymore.
That's right.
Like, I mean, when you consider the compressed SNL schedule, it's you have to wonder how sick he got that he decided to cancel, but then was fine.
You know, the thing to remember too is SNL was produced that year for the last time by Dick Ebersole, who. You know, by that point in time, was already negotiating with McMahon if it hadn't already been signed for Saturday night's main event. So they were all in bed together at that time.
So you think Vince was like, I need you to make Steve Landisberg sick?
No, I don't think it's that. But, you know, I think Dick Ebersole was going to try to find a way. If he knew that Saturday night's main event was already going to air in the Saturday Night Live time spot in a few months, then it benefited him to do that. And again, during that time, too, I believe he was the executive producer of all late night shows outside of Johnny Carson. So that means David Letterman. And of course, Vince had a presence on there a few times too.
Until he didn't.
Although that video of them with the baby, the first baby of the year, is actually pretty funny. Yeah. Vince is pretty good there.
Although I've never seen the one that ended their relationship where Vince came on as a guest.
Oh, I've seen that.
Oh, you have? Do you have
it? Yeah, that's on YouTube. Okay. I saw it on YouTube. Yeah.
Where Vince is just as a regular guest, and And Letterman makes a comment about him looking jacked or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Okay, you have to find this for me because I think I looked for it and I couldn't find it.
I'll try to find it. If we find it, we'll put that in the playlist as well so the listeners can check it out.
Yeah, I did not know unless it's recent that it showed up on YouTube. Because I know Bob Arnett telling me about it, that he was on and it was – oh, it was because I wrote something in Daily Update around on the day of the Letterman finale. And I linked to the various Letterman wrestling stuff. So Lawler and Kaufman, Killer Kowalski, Blassie and Kaufman, and that. And then I think Bob emailed me to tell me about that Vince was like in the running to become a recurring fixture. And then Vince got angry over whatever Letterman said because Bob put it to me, I think, was that like Vince perceived it as Letterman saying he was on steroids.
I don't remember that. I remember it being, and it could be, and I'm just remembering wrong, but I remember it being more that, as seen in the other clips that exist, Dave just did not take Vince seriously at all. And Vince takes himself very seriously, and Dave would just kind of laugh at every single thing. And I don't think Vince appreciated that.
He was being earnest announcer Vince.
Right. Well, he was that other time, but this time he was a guest, and he thought he'd be treated with some respect, and it was really just Dave being Dave.
There's a lot of Letterman, I think, on YouTube now, though. So there's maybe more than there used to be. Like, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but if for anyone who's never seen the Mandy Patinkin Letterman stuff,
yeah,
that is great. I love that. I didn't see that. I never saw that stuff until pretty recently, but I really like that. So, yeah, we're getting too far from the topic.
I think once we start getting far from the topic, it's a good time to wrap it up.
Yes, if we're just not talking about wrestling anymore.
Right. We'll do a separate show that we just talk about popular culture. But for this show...
That one will be called 1235.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I think it's about time to wrap this one up, Bix.
Now I keep hearing exactly in all these different accents each week. It's wonderful.
Bix.
Yes?
Exactly. Thank you. I'll be here all week. Try the veal. Tip your waiters. All right. Well, listen.
That's some Borscht Belt humor at its finest.
Well, hey, I'm more Jewy than you.
Indeed.
So wrap it up, Bix.
Yes, you're the Jewy. Nothing more Jewish than having Vince Russo at your bar.
Hey, as we will talk about on next week's episode, not only did I have Vince Russo at my bar mitzvah, you want to talk about how Jewish I am? I defeated a Nazi wrestler at my bar mitzvah.
Oh, my God.
He wasn't just a wrestler. He was a wrestler who was a Nazi sympathizer or a Nazi itself. I'm not exactly sure. His theme song was Springtime to Hitler. His name was Skull Von Kraus. He did the Sig Heil. And he's the guy I had a showdown with at my bar mitzvah. We'll leave you with that.
Imagine if you booked the Harris twins.
Yeah, as what, caterers?
No, they could have booked them as like the general article.
I know.
Oh, son of a... Okay. So we are on iTunes now. I have to check exactly if that's like automatically, the proper iTunes thing is like automatically linked in each post or whatever now, but otherwise I'll make sure to link it anyway. Stitcher should be working, I think, because like it was almost set up, but when I clicked the URL, it wasn't ready yet, but it should be working by now, I think. And of course the feed itself is feeds.feedburner.com/605pod if you just want to plug that into whatever non-iTunes program you use for podcasts. But yeah, obviously if you're using iTunes, just use the iTunes link and that's the best way to do it. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Follow Brian on Twitter at Great Brian Last. I guess listen to the, I'm guessing most of the people listening to this listen to Between the Sheets, but of course Brian was on this week's Between the Sheets, talking to me and Chris Sellner about 1985. And I guess that's about it, right?
Tally ho.
Tally ho.
Dancer. You work in Las Vegas. You're 33, maybe a little older.